I read a little story about a mother and a daughter who were in a great deal of conflict, and the mother says, you know, I just don't understand this. She said, we used to have such a wonderful time. We used to be able to have such wonderful talks, and, you know, life used to be so good. And said, and the daughter says, boy, Mom, that's right. You've really changed. What happened? And that is a true statement. We do change, our kids change, and we change, and then our circumstances mold us. And someone has said that once a parent, always a parent. You know, you think that when the kids grow up and move out of the house and get married and establish their own home, that you're through parenting. The question then is, why do you still worry so much? And why are you still so involved in their lives? And why are they always calling home and moving home and doing all kinds of things? And so I'd like to just start by reading a little of Proverbs chapter 4, related to a father's instruction, is what it says in my Bible. Hear, O sons, the instruction of a father, and give attention that you may gain understanding, for I give you sound teaching. Do not abandon my instruction. When I was a son to my father, tender and the only son in the sight of my mother, then he taught me and said to me, let your heart hold fast my words. Keep my commandments and live. Acquire wisdom, acquire understanding. Do not forget nor turn away from the words of my mouth. Do not forsake her and she will guard you. Love her and she will watch over you. The beginning of wisdom is, acquire wisdom and with all your acquiring, get understanding. Prize her and she will exalt you. She will honor you if you embrace her. She will place on your head a garland of grace. She will present you with a crown of beauty. Hear, my son, and accept my sayings, and the years of your life will be many. I have directed you in the way of wisdom. I have led you in upright paths. When you walk, your steps will not be impeded, and if you run, you will not stumble. Take hold of instruction. Do not let go. Guard her, for she is your life. Do not enter into the path of the wicked, and do not proceed in the way of evil men. Avoid it. Pass not by it, and turn away from it, and pass on. For they cannot sleep unless they do evil. And they are robbed of sleep unless they make someone stumble. For they eat the bread of wickedness and drink the wine of violence. But the path of the righteous is like the light of dawn that shines brighter and brighter until the full day. The way of the wicked is like darkness. They do not know over what they stumble. My son, give attention to my words. Incline your ear to my sayings. Do not let them depart from your sight. Keep them in the midst of your heart, for they are life to those who find them, and health to all their whole body. Watch over your heart with all diligence, for from it flow the springs of life. And I'll stop there. This is a passage which is a pleading of a father to a son to follow the instruction that they have been taught. And of course, the father here realizes that they may not. And so it's, say, really, instead of following me, you follow wisdom. And wisdom, of course, is a word that would be used for God, in a sense, in the book of Proverbs. Follow the ways of God. And I don't know of anything that would be more in our hearts for our children is that they would grow up and follow God with all their heart, that they would keep their heart with all diligence, that they would not go in the way of wicked men, that they would run away from sin and evil, and that they would really turn their hearts toward wisdom. But that's not always the case. And just like it wasn't the case with them, nor was it the case with us. Now, as we think a little bit about this topic today, I think there are two things to think about, and I wrote them up Mary and I wrote them at the top of the page. Once a parent, always a parent, and once a child, always a child. How many of you have parents that are still living? Okay, several of you do. In some ways, you are still a child to those parents. And I don't know whether you remember back when you were younger, especially in your marriage, and you would visit one or the other of the in-laws, and something strange happened to you or to your husband or wife as you went into that home where they grew up. And what happened was you reverted to habit patterns, to ways of communication, to feelings inside, to arguments, to strange things that went on inside. I don't know whether that happened with you, but it does with most. The same thing happens with your children when they're around you. There is some reversion back to memories that they may either like or not like, or securities that they want or don't want. And so we all live as a parent, and we all live as a child. I remember, I don't think Mary was on this program, but I did an hour-long interview program a couple years ago related to this topic, and I fully expected a lot of parents to call in. Half the callers were children in their late 20s who were deeply frustrated with their parents because they either controlled or they wouldn't let go or they tried to manipulate or put guilt upon them and all of those things. And so it's really a two-way problem that we're talking about here when we think of adult children, their viewpoint and ours, and we're going to try and present both of those. But Mary now is going to share something from one of the most famous theologians of this century, Irma Bombeck.
Well, she does have a way of hitting the nail on the head, doesn't she? And in one of her columns, she was writing about this issue of releasing our children, launching them. And she says, if it's true that life begins when the kids are grown and the dog dies, then why do parents have all that wisdom left over? You'd really think that at the end of 20 years of child raising, we'd come out even. But we don't. I've seen parents fight to keep from running down the aisle at their child's wedding, screaming, "Wait, I'm not finished with you yet." We're upset because we go from being a supervisor of a child's life to being a spectator, and it's rather like being a vice president of the United States. We'll condense this, but there's so much we wanted to tell them. We wanted to share that the number of checks in the checkbook doesn't necessarily coincide with the money left in the account. And we want to tell them that federal taxes really aren't a personal option. And we want to tell them that food left in the refrigerator becomes restless and it can't be made well by reheating in the microwave. The empty nest really hits us hard once we were center stage in their lives, and now we look out and the audience has left the theater and they didn't even turn out the lights. Why aren't we surprised?
I think that really expresses some of our feelings. There's both the sadness and the gladness to the adulthood, but mostly there is a lot of gladness, particularly I think in the grandchildren. I think they are a tremendous bright spot, and to some of the children. And with some of our kids are incredible relationships, and in some ways are incredible in other ways, that they are not easy and they are not good. Now, the best thing that I know is that we ought to think about ourselves, because it doesn't do too much good to think about how our children should respond to us. If we'll think about ourselves, that we're the only people we can change. And we can understand them, but we can't make them do anything. We can't make them think in a certain way. And we may not even be able to talk to them much about this. I feel our book is read both by younger people who are trying to relate to their parents and parents who are trying to relate to their young adults. Ann Landers had an interesting comment. She says, never has a group tried so hard and been blamed so much as today's parents. And I think that is happening. There is a tremendous movement that is afoot right now in the entire counseling community, and I'm not at all down in counseling, but I just want to say what is happening, that nobody is responsible for their actions, and everything that's happened to them is a result of some kind of abuse or as a result of the way what their parents did or did not do, and that they have to both be held responsible and confronted. Now, Mary and I both, if we had a two-hour session, we'd share some of our own testimony in detail, but let me just share a couple things. I come from a divorced home, and I was raised until I was 9 by my grandfather. I didn't even meet my father until I was about 13. And so right after World War II, I moved out to Spokane, Washington with a new stepfather whom I did not know and did not particularly get along with and who was not particularly expressive. And I know they went through a lot of traumas in their marriage. And I'm sure if I go back and try and examine it, I could see where he didn't communicate much at all And we didn't really, I think, Mary felt she never got to know my dad until my mother died. You know, and then really found out he's a person and a personality in and of himself. And you know, I could look back and find all kinds of stuff, but somehow, in my personal upbringing, it had never occurred to me that they had any responsibility after I left, and that I was simply responsible for myself. And they'd never, you know, I felt a wonderful relationship. But, you know, if I look at the home objectively, it's not the home that I particularly wanted to make for my own kids, because we wanted some different things. But that is not what is happening in this day and age. Now, most adult children who are of the baby boomer era are looking back and saying that what is wrong with me is your fault, the parents. And we may want to talk more about that. Why don't you just say something about your family, hon, so that...
I was raised in a Christian home, in a close, tight environment in the community, very small community in Minnesota, so that I had the support not just of my parents, but grandparents, aunt and uncles, close friends all my life. A very strong Christian environment, lots of teaching and so on. My father was a very strong authoritarian individual, and my mother was not an aggressive lady. And so that was kind of the pattern in our home. And Jerry and I found as we married that we needed to make some reversals from that pattern, that did not necessarily fit us. And so it was a good environment growing up. I think my folks made mistakes, but I see that their purpose and their motives and their love were without question. And that, you know, I have no basis on which to fault my parents, because as I look back and I see their model of strong faith in God and strong walk with Him and love for us and prayer for us, you know, what more can you ask of parents, really, that they give to their children?
Both Mary and I, when we left our homes, there was never, from I think the time either, both of us were 18, I doubt if our parents ever gave us one word of advice. It was, I mean, for Mary, it was incredible control until she was 18. And bang, stopped. Not that we, and for some reason, we didn't expect it. There wasn't. We went into a different world, both academically and professionally, than our parents were in. And so they really didn't have much relationship to the world, but there were other areas. But it was kind of a total change. We're going to divide our discussion into two phases, and I'll take a little poll here in a minute to figure out where we should concentrate. One is the volatile person of 16 to 22 years of age, where sometimes you're a child, sometimes you're a teen, and sometimes you're an adult, and you're never sure which, and in 5 minutes they can be all three. It just happens like that. And then into the very independent, anxious ages of 22 and up, when all the new things happen in their lives. They get married, they get into a job of their own, and they have children, and all those things start happening in their lives. And during this time, the parents are usually worrying and interfering, praying, talking, regretting, and wondering why Proverbs 22:6 didn't work like they thought it would. Now, I'd like to just find out, how many of you have still children between the ages of 16 and 22? Can I just see your hands? Okay, three of you, and then the rest are 22 and over, 22 and over two, okay? you're both, okay? Okay, well, what I think we're going to do is there will be a couple things that we'll leave out, and I'll tell you what they are, and if you want to pursue it a little more in detail, we can do it, because we're very flexible, and particularly with a group that's small, we can flex around quite a bit. So if it doesn't follow the pattern on your little book, you can find this. We'll just follow whatever we need. I like this. But Mom, I've been grounded for 32 years. And some people actually feel that way, of course. Now, although I've written it out, I'll go ahead and put this up. What the goal is for our adult children
And then the busters are the we generation, which differs from the us in that it's we, the busters, alone against everybody else, a very defensive kind of posture against the rest of the culture. Wake up, my dear.
Okay. I just wondered. I wonder how much long that's been unplugged. Tape went unplugged there for a little bit.
The establishment had societal absolutes. For those of you who can think back, you remember that there was sort of a set pattern of life. But with the boomers, it's kind of do your own thing. And with the busters, no absolutes. Whatever is kind of the attitude. Then establishment is politically conservative. You'll see that next week. Boomers, for the most part, politically radical. And the busters are politically pragmatic, whatever's good for me, not for the whole bunch. In communication, establishment tactful, boomers candid, and busters openly honest. Now, they're all good. I'm not saying that these things are good or bad. I'm not placing a value. But it's just the style in which these groups of people choose to communicate. The difference between candid and openly honest, candid is more of an exchange. I say something very basic and truthful, and you say it back to me. And sometimes when there's breakdown in communication between, say, an establishment parent and a boomer child, it's because the establishment parent is trying to be so tactful, and the boomer child wants them to spit back just like they have spit at the parents to begin with.
That's where confronting comes in. The boomer
right.
will confront
right.
those in the establishment. The last thing they'd probably ever do is go back and confront their parents for something that they didn't like.
And the busters are openly honest, which means they want to state their position but not necessarily hear yours. Survival mentality, competitive, and entitlement. We'll talk a little more about the entitlement mentality. Survival, that makes sense. Depression, World War. Competitive, there are so many of them, they had to scramble, compete, strive, and fight for their place in a very large group of people. The entitlement mentality, we'll just hold off till that next chart, Jerry. Community-oriented, need-oriented, and world-oriented, just kind of in their view. Okay.
We're going to give, we have a copy of it,
Okay.
If you don't mind. I know you copied it down, but I made a copy of that one to give out to you.
Did you bring that chair?
Yep, I've got it. I am...
Okay, I think just talk a little more about the busters, you know, the 20s to 30s, and because these lines are quite ill-defined, actually. But here are some words. Did you make a handout of this?
No, I did not.
Here are some words that define the baby busters and the way they think.
I have a copy of this, too. So.
Think and behave.
Why don't you read some of them?
Okay, fractured families. This is the first generation, well, let me rephrase that. The baby busters are willing to make one relational commitment, and that is to their children. Most of them don't have any yet, but this is where they say they will be committed, not to their spouse, not to their job, but to their children, because so many have come through fractured families and they have been left alone at home, and they have not received what they perceive to be the attention that they wanted and the relationship in the family, so they're committed to their kids. Skeptical, I see that with my baby, Buster, just in the way she perceives, you know, I don't know if this is going to work out, or I don't know if I believe that person, and so on. Holistic, they're networkers, innovative, single. So if your kids are in that age, they're probably marrying later and later, especially the higher education they have. Dysfunctional, individual loyalty rather than, say, community, corporate, family loyalty, anti-institutional, and do you ever see that in the church? These kids are leaving the church in droves unless their individual needs are being met. High tech, you know, they all play video games, they all know how to program the VCR, all this kind of, they're not intimidated by high tech because they've grown up with it. Unisex, this is the first generation that has grown up totally under feminism and the feminist influence. If your son says to you, well, Mom, she's really a good friend, he probably means it. Or if she says, he's just a good friend. Because they have, I think, healthy friendships. Now, there's plenty of romance out there. I don't mean that that's gone by the board, but they have one of the side effects that I think is positive to the feminist movement, and there are some I think are exceedingly negative, but one of the positive ones is that they can develop these friendships, and somehow they know whether it's friendship or whether a little romance is coming mixed in. The word entitlement is not on here, but this generation has the feeling, and it's anti-boomer, it's not anti-establishment, because for a buster, somebody in the establishment, you know, might as well be gone, because life must be over after age 45. You know? So this is mostly against the boomers. They feel they have polluted the environment. They have scarfed up the good jobs. They have run up the national debt. And all of these negative things that we see in our culture, they place the blame on the boomer generation. And they, from that develops this sense of entitlement. You have it, I want it, and I should have it. The government can take care of me, or Mom and Dad can take care of me. 75% of the young men between 18 and 24 are either living at home or are supported completely by their parents. And 50% of the people in that age group are living at home. So you can see that the girls are heading out sooner than the boys. And then from age 26 to 35, there are still 11% of the people living at home and enjoying all the benefits, Mom and Dad's swimming pool and the 48-inch TV and, you know, and Mom doing the laundry and cooking without paying for it.
There's a sense, and when they go out on their own, they do not want to go with a little house and crummy furniture. They want everything perfect. And one of our children are very different in this regard, but one of our children, they want the best of everything. And they would rather have only one room furnished and have it with the best than to have something that isn't. And
To have one dress only from the best shop, then three dresses from Penny's or whatever.
So there's this sense of entitlement, too, that many of this generation feel that they are entitled to what many of us worked 20 years to attain, and really expect to be provided with that. This cartoon's kind of a interesting one. Two ladies talking. Money isn't everything, but it keeps me in touch with the children.
So, I was driving with our youngest daughter up on a university campus, and a car ahead of us had a bumper sticker that read, "I love Daddy's money." And I thought, yeah, that's kind of... Now, I want to say there are exceptions.
Many exceptions.
Many exceptions. But when we think of these generalized attitudes, remember that even if your kids are not gearing in exactly, they're living in that environment, and that is the mentality of their friends and their peers.
And it will affect them. It definitely will affect them. Is that it?
Am I done?
I
guess
think you're done.
You go ahead. Yeah. Wait.
Why do you think that is? What are some of the reasons for the Western definition of generosity? You alluded to divorce, the high divorce rate. The fact that that certainly influences. What are some of the other ones?
Well, part of the issue is the era in which they grew up. We grew up, the establishment generally was in a very materialistic, saving-oriented, investing-oriented kind of thinking and mentality. And so they, many of them, now this is not true in the very poor and so forth, but in the middle class, they got used to having some of these things, but then they began to resent it in the 60s. They saw this blatant materialism and the goal orientation, and so the 60s generation rebelled against, as you well know, the hippie generation. They rebelled against this. It happened in Europe. It happened here. And then when they came back into the mainstream, they became extremely competitive because of the numbers of them. And so they, and there were also some great opportunities. It was a time of great economic growth in the United States. And they became very, very active in things, and they formed their own culture. No one really knows how culture is formed. Combination of tradition, incidents in the world. Vietnam had a tremendous mark, for instance, on our culture of today, and you see it in the election. Have you noticed that no one says anything about the Gulf War? I mean, it's just like it didn't happen. But Vietnam, because of the draft thing and all of that, there, this sense of I want to be my own person came out so much in the 60s. And it's hard to identify where it came from. It's hard to identify where these trends develop. But they do. Media, attitudes, moving away from spiritual foundations and yeah. Right, Schaefer predicted it. He saw, and largely the materialism, the God of society, and the moving away from the fundamentals. The parents made the move largely.
It was complacency.
Yeah, we did, and a complacency
on the part of Christian parents.
And so the hippie generation, especially the Jesus movement, I think had a tremendously positive effect. Then, as the you get into the busters now, the mainstream now is the boomers. And I don't know who's going to win the election next week, but a lot of the boomers will vote for Bill Clinton because he is of that particular era of the baby boomers, whether or not, depending on politics aside and all the other things aside. But I think it's important to realize that even though we can't always define the why,